From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll hear from a UW-Madison professor who used the first cookbook written by a Black woman to inspire a new book of poetry.
When I discovered this cookbook, I was just struck by how the recipes themselves were like poems.
A Milwaukee healthcare worker explains the impact getting the coronavirus vaccine has had on his life.
Getting the dose isn't necessarily the easiest thing in the world, and I kind of felt like this would be a moment where a weight would be lifted off of our shoulders, that we're moving forward, that we're being more effective.
Plus, we'll tell you about five things to do this month to celebrate Black History and Valentine's Day. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll learn about a new interactive play. We'll hear how a frontline worker's life has changed since receiving the COVID-19 vaccine. We'll tell you about five things you can do in the city this month and how you can explore the Milwaukee Public Museum virtually. We'll start with the historic battle Black women are continuing to fight. Challenging racism and misogyny, demanding equality and justice. These themes are what drive poet Shireen Sherard's work. In her collection called Grimoire, the UW-Madison English professor explores the life and recipes of Melinda Russell, the first known Black woman to publish a cookbook. Sherard intertwines her work with the perspective of a modern Black female narrator. Sherard spoke to WUWM's Mayon Silver about her work, starting with what inspires her.
I'm really inspired by history, especially African-American history. And so a lot of my poems seek to engage or recover or explore voices that might have been stifled, especially during like the 19th century under slavery, but also just anything that really strikes my fancy. You know, I write a lot about food and about the places that I visit and also about my family.
So your most recent collection mixed the recipes of Melinda Russell, the first African-American to publish a cookbook, with narration from contemporary Black mother and amateur cook. Can you tell me a little bit about Russell and why you chose, is it pronounced Grimoire?
Grimoire. Yes, I can talk about the title and also, I encountered Melinda Russell's cookbook in a collection of Black culinary history by an author. Her name is Toni Tipton Martin, and she's a culinary historian. And when I discovered this cookbook, I was just struck by how the recipes themselves were like poems. And I was also just, you know, in awe of the fact that a woman living at the time that she did, she was a free woman, but, you know, living through the Civil War, decided that she would produce, you know, her own cookbook in her own words as a method of support for herself. And she also had a disabled son. And so that struck a chord with me, this idea of a single mother producing her own cookbook. And from there, I envisioned the book as a dialogue in some way. And I wanted it to be a book that would think about the process of making in terms of food and preparation, but also in terms of what it takes to bring up a Black child in the world that we live in now.
And why was it important to connect a modern Black woman with her ancestors?
I think it's just a sense of continuity, right? I think a lot of the poems in the book talk about what is inherited. Trauma is one of the things that's inherited, and several of the poems talk about that. But we also pass down survival skills. And that's one of the things that that kind of advice or the things that might sustain us, that's something I also wanted to focus on. And the title also comes from that as well. So Grimoire is an archaic name for a magical textbook. And so this is the kind of book that alchemists would use to write down spells, but they often wrote them in the form of receipts or what we would know as recipes. And so that word recipe and receipt was often interspersed or used, you know, to describe instructions for a variety of different things. And that's part of why I liked that as a title, the combination of something that might be recipes for dishes and food, but also for advice and cures and other kinds of things to remember.
Well, one of the poems that you've brought to read today is called Restoring the Hair to Its Original Color, and that kind of plays a little bit on that receipt recipe idea. Would you be able to read that one for us?
Sure, yeah, I'm happy to do that. So several of the poems, again, engage or draw on language from Melinda Russell's recipe. So you'll hear at the end of this poem some lines that are actually from a recipe that's in her book that has the same title, Restoring the Hair to Its Original Color.
They don't tell you how it will age you, the lack of sleep, the cracked nipples, the constant buzzing and running hither and thither. When he was born, my son's hair was black and slick. As he grew, it curled, then bronzed like his father's. What started as a silver streak over my left temple spread like a platinum coronet. I dare you to combine 2 drams of lac sulfurous with 8 ounces of rose water. Shake thoroughly. Apply every night before bed.
This poem sort of contrasts the youth of the baby and its hair with the aging impacts of sort of childbearing on the mother. And then if we could just look at a little bit the clever discussion at the end, lac sulfurous, I had to look it up. It's used for treating skin diseases, not necessarily gray hair, but maybe there's hope if you add rose water, ha ha ha. So, yeah.
Reading some of these recipes, you know, she would have recipes in there like to make magic oil or, you know, to cure warts, you know, and, you know, some of them do have the cores of herbalism or a kind of midwives apothecary. And some of these things we still do use, you know, things like raspberry leaf tea, you know, for hormonal balance. So some of that stuff is are remedies that you might use, but others like this, that's why I have that whole note there about, I dare you to do this because I don't know. I have a highly doubt that this would produce the desired result.
Right. And, you know, it must have been kind of fun looking through those and kind of taking a modern perspective on them a little bit.
It was. I mean, I actually tried to cook. I cooked quite a few of the recipes, making adjustments along the way, kind of like my own version of that book by Julie Powell, Julia and Julia. I don't know if you remember. It was a
yes, there was
film.
A movie, right.
Yeah, I really liked that idea, you know, of the dialogue between the two. That's the other reason that I pair the speaker as a 21st century mother and a 19th century mother. I like this idea of this dialogue, but across, you know, 2 centuries, but both single mothers, both very concerned with the care of their child.
That's a theme that you have throughout Grimoire, is the idea of ancestral knowledge and on the exploration of Black motherhood. February is actually Black History Month. How does your poetry connect you to your ancestors and the importance of mothers in Black history?
Well, the first part of Grimoire, you know, is this dialogue with, you know, a Black mother, right, from the 19th century, who you know, just did some amazing things. But I think the more contemporary part of Grimoire, and the second section in particular, looks at health disparities in terms of birth outcomes for Black women and how drastic the difference is in the rates of both infant mortality, but also just you know, survival, right, and flourishing after birth as well. And that was, I would say, somewhat of an unexpected connection that the second section of the book dealt with. And it really came from me reading an article by Linda Villarosa in the New York Times that talked about how the mortality rates were better under slavery when Black women were forced to reproduce a labor force, not under their own, you know, volition, than they are now. And that was just a really striking note for me to realize, and those health disparities I think have only increased under the pandemic.
And you've brought another poem that sort of is in that similar vein and similar context called Weathering. Would you be able to read that one?
Sure. Yeah. So weathering is a term by a public health advocate named Arlene Geronimus, and it just speaks about the ways in which exposure to systemic racism and other kinds of environmental toxins can actually be passed down through the DNA, right? Not just metaphorically, but actually changing the health outcomes for women and their children. And so thinking about the trauma that enslaved women experienced and the fact that along with everything else, that's something that can be passed down. And that's what this poem, Weathering, gets at.
None of us in the prenatal clinic are the right age. We are climbing or descending the bell curve. The 18 to 35-year-olds are still at happy hour. They spend their petty cash on pedicures. Think of your shoelace, the genetic counselor says, benignly. The plastic tip that keeps the cotton from unraveling. That's the telomere. It protects your legacy. In your people, it has come off. Peeled away like a chimney from an F4 twister by a toxicity that seeps and creeps until your womb is all black mold in need of remediation. All you glean from this prognosis, please strap yourself into the stirrups. An audience of white coats anticipates. This silence is for saving lives that matter, not salvaging slaves. A nurse secures the shackles as a surgeon lifts your paper gown to expose one breast. He whispers what Cassiopeia must have said to sturdy Andromeda before leaving her for the Kraken. Be not afeard. After this last trial, you will be magnified, astral, a consolation.
And the last word, a constellation, it seems almost like there could have been an implication that you would have said constellation, but then it's like people who are going through these things end up needing to be consoled. Is there anything else that you would want to unpack, maybe a little bit about the mythology?
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted the movement in the poem to go from this, you know, idea of the speaker being in a clinic, right? And the idea of being a prenatal or a birthing clinic. And I remember, you know, going to those places in my mid-20s or mid-30s and thinking that, you know, that's really the ideal time, right, to have a child, right? So this notion that you don't want to be too young a mother, and then as you're older, right? So there's this fear as you get older that the health, right? The eggs are, you're losing eggs. You know, there's all of this anxiety that goes into procreation for women and trying to balance childbearing, child rearing, all of these things with career and family. So I wanted to capture that and also just the intensity that, the specific intensity that Black women experience moving into those spaces and not necessarily being treated with the same care or seen in the same way. Also, there's an undercurrent there when they say, you know, this science isn't for salvaging slaves. What we know about the history of obstetrics is that a lot of the tools that were developed in this field were basically tested out on enslaved women, right? So there's also, I think, this deep fear and distrust of medicine that's running through this, and the sense of someone being sacrificed, right, for the good of another person. And that's why I think there's the turn, you know, towards the classical, that image of Andromeda being sacrificed by her mother, right? And, but then you're right. Yeah, I think at one point that I think of, you know, the constellations, right? You know, there's this idea that your reward is in the heavens, right? Which is also, you know, a bit of tongue in cheek there to ask people to look to the afterlife as opposed to the present.
And this the image of the telomere shortening and peeling away like a chimney in an F4 twister, that's very powerful. And there was a study out of Auburn University that African Americans who reported more racial discrimination over a 10-year period showed signs of faster aging at the cellular level during that time frame. Were you alluding to that too?
Exactly, right. And also the fact that this is something that cuts across class, because a lot of times we'll think, oh, well, you know, if people have maybe more education or they have more money or something like that, that these are going to abate these issues. But in fact, there's a lot of evidence to say they're in, you know, it's maybe a different degree, but there is that intensity still maintains, and that the birth count outcomes from the research I've looked at are actually better for younger mothers because there's just been less time that they've been exposed, right? It's not like they haven't experienced racism. It's just that there's a difference between what they've experienced at the age of 20 versus when you get to 35.
Very meaningful and interesting poems here. So Shireen Sherard, thank you very much for sharing them on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Shireen Sherard is a UW Madison English professor and poet. Tomorrow we'll hear from her husband, fellow poet and UW Madison professor Ahmad Johnson. The California native will also read some of his poems and describe life in Compton after the Rodney King uprising. Live performances have taken a big hit during the pandemic. Most theaters have been unable to reopen because of safety concerns, which can be challenging for directors and actors alike. How do you create a live show in a virtual setting and engage audiences in the same way you do in person? It's a difficult task, but one that First Stage Children's Theater is tackling with its new show, Escape from Peligro Island. It's a make-your-own adventure show, where kids can vote on what the actors do next, creating a unique show with each performance. Jeff Frank is the artistic director at First Stage, and he's also directing Escape from Peligro Island. Frank is joining me along with one of the performers, Nadja Simmons, to talk about the show. Nadja, Jeff, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
When you decided you wanted to produce this show, what were some of the initial hurdles that you had to overcome with this new format?
Well, one of the reasons I chose the show is that I thought it would work well, given the fact that we were going to do an all virtual season. So we're looking for pieces that could work in the digital format, but would ask audiences to lean into the work in a different sort of way. And by choosing to produce this create your own adventure option, it really allows the audience to vote throughout the show and watch closely and, you know, try to decide the next choice for our hero. So it was a way to hopefully engage audiences in a different sort of way than most of the stuff, you know, most of the digital work that we're seeing. You know, you could sit back and it doesn't really matter how involved you are or not. So this sort of demands a level of interaction that I think is really exciting.
As you mentioned, there's a lot of interaction, which sounds great when you're talking about engagement with these kinds of virtual shows. We've done our own, and it can be hard to engage people. That being said, how does it work exactly? Because it is a create your own adventure play. How do you incorporate that in a virtual format?
Well, the audiences will use their phone. So there are, you know, depending on which directions they go, there are anywhere from, you know, 8 to 12 times that they might be able to vote, simple A or B. Is it, you know, will our hero, after his plane crash, follow the footprints or head toward the cockpit where the radio might be alive yet? And each of those decisions has very specific ramifications in terms of how it goes.
Yeah. Nadja, as a performer, what is it like doing a virtual show, but especially doing a virtual show like this one?
Sure. So since the pandemic happened, I've done a couple other virtual shows, which have all been different, but none quite as different as this show. I even said, like, when I first got cast, I was like, this might be one of the most challenging things I've done yet to date, because of just the, you never know what's going to happen next. You know, we have a script that has a million different ways we can possibly go to complete the story that our main character Calloway goes on. And it's just all up to the audience to tell us what to do next, you know? So we really have to be on our toes and super prepared. But I'm really excited that we're doing it in this way, because like Jeff said, it really does have this extra audience participation aspect that I've missed from not being live on stage.
I was about to say, theater is something that I think theatrical actors especially appreciate how ephemeral it is, this connection that
it's something unique to that format. How does it feel being in a virtual setting where, yes, you do have the eye contact in some ways with the audience, but it's fundamentally different?
It is. I think that for me, like, the reason I love live theater is hearing the audience reactions, like hearing the laughter, hearing the gasps of surprise, or hearing the reaction from it and really getting that intimate interaction with them. And so not having that has definitely been a challenge, because we're not trying to go into film, I think. Like we're not film, that's not the route we're going with this or with a lot of virtual shows. We still want to make it a theater performance. It's just in a different way. And so even though we're missing that direct audience communication, the connection between us as actors is still there. Like, we can still see each other and talk to each other, which has been really helpful to connect with our people, you know, again. And that's something that I've definitely held close through this process. But it's different. It is different. And I think that is something I'm looking forward to getting back in the theater. But the cool thing about this is that we've discovered almost a new medium on how to put out art, which is this mix between theater and film, whatever it's called. And I don't think that's going to go away anytime soon, which is exciting.
Jeff, what is it like for you directing shows that are going to be, you know, not on a stage like they would normally be?
It's, as Nadja said, it's a challenge, right? A lot of pre-planning, you know, and blocking in a different sort of way. We are working with open broadcast software. So we're capturing from Zoom images of the actors and then arranging them as we see fit to tell the story. I sort of equate it to a living graphic novel, and that there are illustrated backgrounds and moments of animation that pop in. And then these actors sort of exist in these comic book or graphic novel panels to help tell a story. But it's working with Nadja and the other actors saying, okay, at this moment, this other actor is to your left and up. So that's your point of focus, right? To try to create that contact so the audience sees the actors as talking to each other versus just talking straight to them through the screen. Although there are times there's a heavy dose of narration. So those storytellers are sometimes talking directly to the audience or sometimes helping focus action on Calloway, our hero. So just a lot of logistics and figuring out how do we do our sort of create the illusion of stage combat or moments of intimacy or, explosions, right? One of the strands, Calloway is a superhero. So how do we illustrate the, you know, flying or running at super speed and other sorts of things like that? So it's still a lot of collaboration with the actors, right? I'm still talking with Nadja about, okay, how do we do this? What was this? Is this comfortable for you? Does this make sense? And that's the part that I've missed. And it's not the same as being in the room, but it's been so wonderful to, you know, be with six super talented actors discussing how do we illuminate this story the best we can in any given moment through this unique medium.
It is such a unique experience, not only the virtual aspect of it, but of course it's a create your own adventure. And so each play is, of course, going to be a little different. When you think about your audience and the kids who are going to watch this, what do you think this kind of play gives to kids that other theatrical performances just don't?
What I love about First Stage is that I feel like there's really something for everyone. And this play is so lovely because I feel like the whole play, any way you go, there's something really for every type of kid. There's vampires, there's superheroes, there's the Wild West. And it really reverts back to what Jeff said about bringing it almost into a comic book type of world, because I feel like that's just so relevant. And even me, I'm like, I didn't connect to really superheroes as a kid, but I loved Twilight and vampire books and movies. So when I heard that, I was like, I'm hooked, you know, and I'm in my 20s. So I just think there really is something for every kid. And the fact that they can also use their devices, which is something that, I mean, I know they've been using in this world so much, but this is in a way where you can still connect to people into theater while using technology. So I think that's just super cool.
And I think there's a, you know, the sense that Calloway, who's at the center of the story, is sort of in every person, right? The audience can easily see themselves. Calloway is this unexpected hero, right? There are challenges that he's dealing with, having, you know, his parents are divorced and living in two different places, and he's back and forth and doesn't have a lot of friends and doesn't know where he really belongs or doesn't know what he's capable of. And I think all of us sometimes want to be tested by a great adventure. We just don't know when that great adventure is going to come, right? And this is a play where that great adventure comes for Calloway. And for us as an audience, we get to travel on that great adventure really with him. And like we've said, you know, dictate the path that Calloway goes down and the choices and looking at the consequences. And frankly, I hope people come back and watch again, right? And see, oh, this is what happened if it had gone this other way. And that's one of the cool things is that you can watch live. Then we'll also have video on demand options available later in the run. So if you witnessed the Western story but really wanted to find out what happened to the Vampire Strand, you could go and say, oh, I can watch the video on demand and know that it's going to be the Vampire Strand and see what happens in that version of the story, which is super exciting.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, Nadja, thank you both so much for joining us today on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Jeff Frank is the artistic director at First Stage and the director of Escape from Peligro Island. Nadja Simmons is one of the actors performing in the show. This Friday and Saturday, you can catch Escape from Peligro Island live and be a part of making the adventure. The recorded show will be streaming through the end of the month, and you can find a link to more information about tickets and times at WUWM.com. Like many artistic and cultural institutions, Milwaukee Public Museum is closed due to concerns about the spread of COVID-19. But coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll tell you about a different way you can explore the museum's exhibits without leaving your home. And if you're looking for other ways to explore Milwaukee culture, Adam Carr from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service is giving us his recommendations on what to do in the city this month. We'll learn about some of the local events celebrating Black History Month and a marketplace to get your special someone a special something. But first, we'll hear from a healthcare worker about how getting the vaccine has changed his life. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Local leaders say Wisconsin is only receiving about 70,000 vaccine doses a week, not nearly enough to keep up with demand. With limited availability, the government has prioritized vaccinating frontline healthcare workers and others in the Phase 1A group. People 65 and older first started to receive their shots last week. We'll hear now from a local healthcare worker about how getting both doses of the vaccine has impacted his life.
Hi, my name's William, and I'm a medical scribe in Milwaukee. So I got the Pfizer version of the vaccine. I got the first dose on December 17th, 2020, and I got the second dose on January 4th. When I found out I was going to get the vaccine, I was actually very excited. I knew that getting the dose isn't necessarily the easiest thing in the world, and I kind of felt like this would be a moment where a weight would be lifted off of our shoulders, that we're moving forward, that we're being more effective. In regards to my personal safety, I definitely felt a lot better because when you're working in the medical field, you don't know what's going to walk through those doors. You want to make sure that you're doing everything you can to be safe, but this adds an extra safety net. It adds a big safety net. The only thing I felt after the first dose was for about 2 days, my left arm where I got the shot hurt. It was tender, it was hard to raise my left arm above the level of the shoulder, but that was it. When I got the second dose of the shot, I woke up at about 3 that morning with chills. I couldn't get warm. I then had body aches, fatigue. I felt pretty under the weather the rest of the day, and I would still get the shot every single time. The side effects could last you 3 to 5 days. Getting the side effects from having serious COVID infection is going to last you your whole life. I definitely didn't feel guilty, and I don't think that anybody should feel guilty for when they get the shot. The only way that this is going to go away is if people get the shot. You should get the vaccine because you go from feeling like you're trapped in your house to feeling like you have a chance, that there's hope.
William is a medical scribe in Milwaukee. To hear more testimonials from Wisconsinites who've received the vaccine, head to WUWM.com. There you can also find all of our coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic, including a recent interview about how to get at-home COVID-19 testing kits. Although February is the shortest month of the year, it's always packed with events. Between Black History Month and Valentine's Day, February has become a time to reflect on our culture, the people we love, and how we show our appreciation. Since the COVID-19 pandemic began, Adam Carr from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service has been joining us to talk about some of the many community events happening here in Milwaukee. The list includes a wide array of things to enjoy, both virtually and in person. Adam Carr, thank you so much, as always, for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Happy to be back for another month.
So February is pretty special, I think, especially here in the city of Milwaukee, in part because it's Black History Month, and there are so many celebrations here for this month.
Absolutely. Preparing for every time I'm going to talk to you for one of these five things segments, I look at a variety of different community calendars, and there really is an abundance of great events happening this February for Black History Month. And so really, it's unfair to choose just a couple, but I have to because we only have five things. My colleague, Anna Martinez-Ortiz, put together a great collection of different events happening, which you can see at our website, milwaukeenns.org. But the first one I want to share with you is from America's Black Holocaust Museum. So I imagine most of our listeners are no stranger to America's Black Holocaust Museum, but they have their brand new space on Vell R. Phillips Avenue and North Avenue. And this month, they're going to be doing different virtual conversations and programs. So they did one earlier this week on Monday. Next week, a lot of folks still haven't met the executive director, Dr. Burt Davis, who I've had a chance to spend some time with, and he's an incredible, dynamic, great leader as the president and CEO of the museum. And he's going to be joined this next Wednesday, so February 10th from noon to 1 p.m. for a digital conversation with the one-man Milwaukee institution, Judge Derek Mosley. Many folks know Derek Mosley just from his incredible spirit and advocacy in the city. He also, every year, every day during Black History Month, posts a pretty substantial post every day, unearthing a different dimension of history, oftentimes going beyond, you know, kind of the regular suspect. So I'm really excited. Dr. Burt Davis, the president and CEO of America's Black Holocaust Museum, is going to be in conversation with Judge Derek Mosley next Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. And you can connect with America's Black Holocaust Museum on any of their platforms to see it.
This next event is also connected to Black History Month, but is a decidedly different take on it, and I think incorporates something else a lot of Milwaukeeans have been trying to do right now, which is supporting small businesses.
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the many downsides to the pandemic or a month like Black History Month is that being out and experiencing things, seeing and soaking in culture in person is really the best way to do it. But obviously, for safety reasons, health reasons, we're not doing that. So put this one on your calendar because it's out a couple weeks. Saturday, February 20th, the MKE Black Group, who has an incredible app where they've aggregated a lot of Black businesses in Milwaukee, they're putting together a Black-owned food trucks event at the Beerline Trail Plaza, which is at 3356 North Holton, just off Townsend. So like Holton and Townsend, from an 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. It's a Saturday, the 20th, and they're going to have at least these three food trucks. Carol's Kitchen. I just checked out each of their pages to see what kind of food they do. They do comfort and soul food. They had like gooey macaroni and cheese right on their cover image, and it made my stomach rumble. America's Finest Cuisine. Africa's finest cuisine. They call them eccentric dishes from Africa and the Somali Bantu culture mixed with homemade recipes. And then also Bebe's Bistro is going to be there as well, who does delicious sandwiches and fries and that kind of stuff. So yeah, absolutely. Black History Month is a lot of things. There's a lot of different ways to experience it. And I think there can be no better way than going and supporting local businesses and treating yourself right for the Black-owned food trucks event.
What's great about it, too, is food can be such a lovely way to engage in someone else's culture, but also support businesses that you know are often hurting right now.
For sure. And I think that actually kind of, you kind of segued us, you're a professional, Joy, into our next one. So our third event is Riverworks, which is a group that works across the River West and Harambe neighborhoods doing community development of all kinds. They have their 53212 marketplace, a virtual market for that someone special. So not only is February Black History Month, it's also right in the middle, you have Valentine's Day. So this Saturday, so this is coming up in just a few days here, from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m., they're doing a virtual showcase of, you know, they were planning to do a marketplace, but they're going to be doing conversations with a lot of the vendors who are they planning to have at this marketplace. I had a chance to check out the first one. I find oftentimes these markets, what's most interesting about them are the stories that each person brings with them. And when you go from table to table, you get a little bit of that. So during this hour, this Saturday, you're going to be able to hear directly from some of these vendors. So there's all kinds of, you know, vendors, food, fashion, art. It's everything from hot sauces to paintings you can put on your wall to a purse you could carry. They've aggregated these great vendors who have a connection to the 53212 zip code to the Harambe and River West neighborhoods. I just, you know, scrolling through the vendors, you know, sometimes you can get a little trapped in the monotony of thinking, you know, who and what's going on in Milwaukee. And looking at that list of vendors, I had a few familiar faces in there, but most of them I hadn't heard of before, which is really exciting. So that is the 53212 Marketplace. Their virtual showcase is happening this Saturday from 11 to noon.
Interesting that there were a number that you didn't know. This has been such an interesting time, I think, for our community. It's been difficult for small businesses, but it's also inspired some people to start new businesses.
You know, that's a very insightful comment, Joy. I mean, you know, like for some people, this time to kind of invest yourself in what you do and your craft and whatever it is. Yeah, there's certainly some people who, without all the distractions of normal life, have been able to kind of level up their business.
Yeah. Now, this next event, I think people may be familiar with the Urban Ecology Center. I'm interested to hear what this Winterfest is.
Yeah, so Winterfest 2021, they're doing it at the Washington Park branch, which is in the middle of Washington Park on the west side of Milwaukee. Their taglines for it are experiencing outdoor play. And if you're like me and you shovel the snow, which you do out of obligation, but there's also snow, while it can be a burden, can also be a way to have a totally different kind of fun. So I think what I like about Winterfest is it's, you know, especially for those indoorsy people like me, it invites people outdoors to play in the park. So they have a sledding station, classic winter activity. They have tracking and nature hike station, ice skating station, a snow science station, snowshoes. So all these things you might not have done before, you know, they make it easy to do. They have hot beverages. They also have the Milwaukee Art Museum. They're doing snow art with sculpting kits. So they really know, the Urban Ecology Center knows how to invite people, whether you're an expert or a beginner, into having fun outside. They just suggest everyone dress for the weather and wear a mask. You can just show up. It's this Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., centering at the Washington Park Urban Ecology Center and the great building they have there in the middle of Washington Park.
So you go to Washington Park, you spend some time in the snow, make a couple sculptures maybe, and then you can participate, it seems like, in this next event, which will really warm you up.
Wow, you're coming with the segues today, Joy. The last event I have for everyone is taking place throughout the entire month of February. It is February. So Pho, P P-H-O, pronounced pho, is a soup that comes from Vietnam, but has kind of made its way throughout Southeastern Asia. And there are three restaurants in the Silver City neighborhood, all between 35th and 34th on National Avenue, that are Lao Thai restaurants. And they've been doing this, I think this is their eighth year doing it. They've been doing February, which is normally, they're actually not doing, they normally do $5 bowls of pho, but with the pandemic and just sort of the slowing down of business, they're not offering the discount. So it's only a few more dollars for a bowl of pho, but they are doing a weekly raffle for people who dine in those three restaurants during February. And those three restaurants are Thai Barbecue, Bamboo, and Vientiane Noodle Shop. So I will, you know, just full disclosure here, we put together a little highlight of just what bowls of pho look like from each of the three places to see what's similar, what's different about them. And me and two of my colleagues, Princess and Anna, we each got bowls of pho and we photographed them. And I was just looking at those pictures earlier and I am hungry. And I'm probably, you know, there's nothing better than on these cold days of winter than a warm bowl of soup. And kind of a, you know, a thread that's been throughout this. These are our neighbors. These are local restaurants. So it's, you know, you're doing good, but you're also treating yourself right.
Pho is maybe one of my favorite soups for when it gets really cold out, just because it's so, it's such a complex but easy flavor.
For sure. And I will say this about pho. It is the broth. It's not the heaviest in the world either. So you can eat it, you'll be stuffed, but you also won't hate yourself when you're done eating it. It isn't one of those things that makes you have to go into a food coma. So I think February, those three restaurants are there all the time and they're always serving pho, but this month is a time that they have that focus.
Yeah. Well, Adam Carr, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect and telling us about all these things.
For sure. I am happy to do it and I'll see you in March.
Adam Carr is the Deputy Editor for Community Engagement at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. Coming up, we'll tell you how you can take a virtual tour of the Milwaukee Public Museum. That's next on Lake Effect here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Many organizations are finding different ways to engage with the public during this pandemic. Right now, the Milwaukee Public Museum is closed, but a new partnership with Google is allowing people back inside the museum without leaving their homes. One of Google Maps' best-known features is Street View, which allows people to zoom in on a location for a closer look. Now you can do the same with the Public Museum Streets of Old Milwaukee or its Living Ocean exhibits. Jenny Tetzloff is the Milwaukee Public Museum's Director of Integrated Marketing. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski last June about this project. She begins by explaining how the partnership between the museum and Google began.
Our Director of Electronic Systems and Information, Greg Post, has been in contact with Google since 2014, actually, to get this up and running. And Google came out and they took some photos and then there was, I guess, some sort of technical glitch on that end. So they came back out just as we were wrapping up our Hidden Wisconsin exhibit, which was a temporary exhibit we did in 2016, 2017. So we were able to get that photographed. And Greg has been working with them to do a lot of different things regarding the museum. And he has been able to push this forward. Once we closed, he got back to them and said, hey, it would be really great. You know, I know we have these photos and we've been going back and forth, but it would be great for the community to be able to see everything while we're closed. And he was able to push that forward.
So you mentioned Google was coming and taking photographs. Can you explain the technical process? Was it, you know, we think of Google Street View satellite images as the car with the big 360 camera going around. So what did it look like to capture the museum in this way?
So they did have three staff members from Google come out with photographers, and they took pictures of everything kind of in a 360 kind of way. And they were able to get a lot of our photos and put those together on their end in the technical way, so to speak.
You mentioned there was a Hidden Wisconsin exhibit in 2016 that we could view right now. Are there any other exhibits or things that were at the museum previously during this time that we can now see today that we wouldn't be able to had museum operations been in normal circumstances?
No, for the most part, many of our exhibits are still the same as they were in 2016, but the Hidden Wisconsin exhibit is really cool because it has a lot of different artifacts and objects and specimens from all over Wisconsin that we don't usually have out either because they are too fragile to be out or they're used mainly for research purposes. And so it's really nice that the community can come back and see those artifacts and specimens and look at them.
On the note of artifacts and specimens, I know a lot of your collection is vastly in storage. So during this time, have you been able to really go through all of the artifacts and kind of regroup and see what you have, what the public hasn't seen, and use this time in a way that will still serve the museum even though people can't come in the doors?
Yes. Our curatorial team has been able to go in, and we always have to manage collections. There are certain temperatures and certain standards that you have to meet. And so our curatorial team is full of amazing people who have been in the museum on and off. I mean, for the most part, most of us are working from home, but they do go in to check specimens. We do have security on staff, making sure that if anything should happen, they can get out and make sure that all of those objects and artifacts and specimens are safe.
So what are the most important aspects of a strategy that you had to develop in order to adapt to the coronavirus, you know, and what other ways are you engaging with visitors during this time?
For us, I would say that the most important thing that we've been doing is really moving into digital resources. So what we started to do is our education team and our curatorial team and a bunch of our other teams have come together, and we have created a weekly newsletter that we send out to people that gives activities that you can do for both children and adults. It highlights different collections. Some of them are on exhibit, but as you said, many of our collections are not on exhibit. And so some of them highlights things that you can't even see, and really moving into the digital realm, be it in, you know, video format. We're going to be doing a breakfast with the curators video. So that's really exciting. And just moving into a digital format so that we can still stay in touch with the community and make sure that they are getting access to really what is their collections.
So down the road, when time does come to reopen, you know, how have you been planning for that? You know, how will the experience for people be different? And I imagine you're working with city and county and health officials to find out the best way to go about things. So what has been at the forefront of your mind and in your planning?
So we do have a reopening committee that has been working with not only other museums in Wisconsin, but also with city and county and state health officials to make sure that everything is safe. I can't really say what that experience is going to look like yet because we're still working through all those processes, and when we can open our doors, I can promise it's going to be a very safe experience for everyone, and you're still going to be able to enjoy all of the objects and exhibits that you've come to enjoy. It'll be a little different, but we're going to make sure it's as smooth as it can possibly be, and definitely the safety of our visitors and our staff is really important to us.
You know, I think fondly upon the time I've been able to go to the museum, whether it's through school or with family, and with that experience just on hold for a little bit, you know, what's one exhibit or perhaps a favorite object of yours that you can recommend to us to look for while taking a virtual tour online?
Well, for me, I love the Crossroads of Civilization exhibit that is on the third floor. We opened that in 2015. We have a Cleopatra coin that I always think is really kind of cool. It's like one of the first female leaders. She has her face on currency, and she's being a strong woman. So I enjoy that one.
Being able to step in front of an artifact such as that, you know, is a crucial point of that museum experience, right? But, you know, do you think museums will have to change the classic brick and mortar model as we adapt from this pandemic? And, you know, it's hard, obviously hard to tell what's going to happen in the future, but now there needs to be a lot of other plans in place, a lot of other measures at the ready.
Sure, but I do think that for museums, like objects and specimens and artifacts are a big part of what we do. And so like, I cannot foresee a future where those items are never going to be at the forefront, because we all have the internet now. We can all go on and look at a picture of something that you can see somewhere else, but there's a different experience when it's directly in front of you. Yes, it may not be the same in terms of tactile experiences and touching. I don't know what that's going to look like yet, but I mean, I think that we will always be a museum where there are objects and specimens and things that you wouldn't ordinarily be able to see in front of you, for sure.
So I know the museum also had a plan in place to build and move to a new space. Obviously, the pandemic disrupts things greatly on all fronts. So do you think this will still be able to happen at some point in the future? What's the museum's goal in working towards that?
Absolutely. They are still moving forward with that initiative. And, you know, we're going to be able to learn a lot of new things about what the future should look like based on what we're going through right now.
Well, Jenny Tetzlaff, thank you so much for your time today, and we look forward to exploring the museum online until we can return again.
Thank you.
Jenny Tetzlaff is the Milwaukee Public Museum's Director of Integrated Marketing, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski last June. And that is today's Lake Effect. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, you can find all of our content as a podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or really wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, look for Lake Effect Spotlight. If you missed yesterday's show and you want to learn more about the science behind sledding, you can find that at WUWM.com. We also featured Racine blues musician Stephen Hull. If you'd like to learn more about what inspired him to play the blues, you can find that conversation at WUWM.com. And join us again tomorrow at 10 for Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.